Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Araqi Voices. This is your host, Hassan Haddad. Araqi Voices is a podcast that showcases authentic perspectives and insights about current developments in Iraq. Araqi Voices is produced by 1001 Araqi Thoughts. In less than 4 weeks, Iraqis will head to the polls and vote in the country's national parliamentary election. To discuss them, I am joined once again by Ali Maulawi, who specializes in Iraq's political economy. Also here is Mohammed Al-Wa'ili, contributor to 1001 Iraqi Thoughts, focused on development and reform in Iraq. Last but not least is Hamza Haddad, an adjunct fellow at the Center for New American Security and editor at 1001 Iraqi Thoughts. To start us off, Hamza, talk to me about the boycott movement and what we can expect in terms of voter turnout this year.
I think the most interesting aspect about the boycott movement this election is the fact that Muqtada Sadr's National Shia Movement will not be participating in this election. And so the party that has been consistent in numbers coming out to vote every 4 years will not be running. And so we might actually see an even further decrease in voter turnout in 2025 than we did see in 2021 or 2018. And what's different with the Sadrs joining the boycott movement is the fact that we're seeing some campaigning from them in the mid-Euphrates and southern Iraq, where they have posters countering election posters and saying, do not vote or boycott this election. And I think that's a very interesting development. I think it's also interesting is that, like the protests in 2019 that were seen as being co-opted by the Sadrs, they're once again co-opting another movement by civil society or the Tishrin-based parties in their countering of Iraq's political elite.
It is interesting, and I did see a couple of videos online of supposed followers of Sadr tearing down campaign posters with songs related to the Sadrist movement. And it actually led to the Independent High Electoral Commission, known as IHEC, to put out a press release reminding citizens that any tampering with campaign posters, the destruction of or vandalization of campaign posters, can lead to fines. So it is something that I think is becoming more prevalent.
I mean, it's true that the Sadrists constitute a large number of voters and their absence will be felt. But on the other hand, we see the other political parties, even before the election season started officially, trying to campaign early by occupying advertising spaces that contains the picture of their politicians or the logos of their parties without having any numbers on it. And this is like a way of circumventing the rules. But it shows that they are getting ready for elections since a very long time now. And it indicates that these elections are going to be very interesting, actually.
Yeah, and I just add that another point about voter turnout is I'd be very surprised if voter turnout is higher than what it was in 2021. I think we have to bear in mind that the way that IHEC calculates voter turnout is based on the proportion of people that are registered to vote. So, i.e. people that have actually got voter ID cards, that's different to the number of people who are eligible to vote. We have to make that distinction because when I had calculated the voter turnout in 2021, it came up with a figure of 43%. And that was based on the fact that 22.1 million people had registered to vote. And of those people, about 9.6 million voted. That's how they calculated 43%. What we know from IHEC figures that were released recently is that 21.4 million people are registered to vote this time around. So that's less than what it was in 2021. So what it means is when they're calculating voter turnout, the lower number of registered voters may actually mask the actual turnout. The other point I would say as well is that so there are about 600,000 to 700,000 people less registered to vote this time around. The question is, who are these people? Now, they could be Sadrists. That's possible. Having said that, we know that Sayyid Muqtada has urged his voters or his people to register to vote despite the fact that he's called on them not to participate in the vote. There could also be people that voted for independent candidates last time around or for the smaller parties. So just bear in mind the fact that because of the change in the electoral system, this current system of proportional representation encourages coalition building as opposed to individuals running on their own or smaller parties. So in my view, I think there are a significant number of people who prefer to elect or to vote for individuals or small parties last time who may not be convinced about voting for these large coalitions this time around.
You're definitely right that there's two ways to measure voter turnout, whether that's the percentage of those that are registered to vote or the percentage of those that voted amongst the whole population that is eligible. And I know that's been used politically, whether to make voter turnout larger or smaller than it is. But I think this time around, since we had a national census last year, we'll have a better picture of the percentage of Iraqis that are actually going out to vote.
And interestingly, by the way, IHEC also put out figures for the number of Hashid personnel that are registered to vote. If you remember last time, the Hashid refused to register for the special vote, which takes place a couple of days before the general vote. And it was thought that it was because, you know, the Hashid as an organization wasn't willing to inform IHEC about how many people they have on their payroll. This time around, they have disclosed these figures to IHEC. And what we know is that 128,000 Hashid personnel have registered to vote, which is far less than what we know are the actual figures of Hashid personnel, which exceeds 200,000. So that actually, I think, raises a lot of interesting questions about the degree to which personnel within Hashid are actually tied to political parties. In fact, it may actually suggest that there is a significant number of personnel within Hashid that are actually not particularly active politically or have ties to the political parties that are linked to the Hashid.
And I guess one positive side effect of all of this is that this time we have more numbers, and I think any conclusions and analysis is going to be more accurate.
I think the fact that we're seeing much more organization from the parties, they were able to campaign a lot earlier, is the fact that we're back to a regular schedule of elections. These aren't early elections like last time. There wasn't really that question of, will elections be held? I remember in 2021, up until days before the formal campaigning started, there was a question of whether these elections will be held or not. And then all of a sudden, you started seeing election posters when it came time to campaign. But like Mohammed said, this time around, you had a lot of parties that were much more prepared. They were more like previous elections where they had campaign posters before formal campaign period began. And maybe the fact that they knew the elections were going to happen at this time, that they were able to register those Hashid figures.
And in terms of election campaigns, I think we do need to acknowledge the current escalation that's taking place with the assassination of a candidate earlier this week. He was a sitting member of the provincial council, and his assassination hit hard given that the last couple of elections have been without such incidents. So, Ali, can you talk to us about this escalation and how quickly the government really needs to tackle this to ensure that we do have a smooth and peaceful election campaign season?
Well, it is certainly very worrying, and we've seen some rising sectarian rhetoric over the past couple of days as well as a result of this assassination. Obviously, there are different camps trying to blame each other for or making accusations about who is responsible for this murder. We don't know who it is, and it really could be anyone at this point. And this is why the government needs to be very quick in ascertaining who is behind this assassination to really ensure that such incidents are not repeated over the next 4 weeks.
And despite the fact that we have to acknowledge this dangerous escalation, Ali, I still think that it does not necessarily mean that the election process is going to deteriorate further. As you said, the government needs to tackle this quickly and thoroughly. But we need to remember that Iraq has gone through a lot, and its violent past does not disappear easily. And so from time to time, we are reminded of this past. And we are also reminded that the election process is not perfect. We, for instance, remember in 2018, the ballot boxes getting burned, and lots of them, actually, and many other incidences. I think what is required is that we stick to the process. We purify it from extortion and violence and inaccuracies and tampering with numbers. And this requires time. I still have hope that this process continues and that we have a successful election.
I think this goes back to our conversation in the last episode, where we were discussing going back to provincial-wide districts from smaller districts. And again, one of the benefits of the smaller districts was it did allow a safer environment to campaign in. You were amongst your own community. You didn't have to travel as far as some candidates do. And I think we're missing a lot of the positives from smaller districts. And one of the consequences was this unfortunate political assassination that I really do hope is a one-off, because it could be a dangerous escalation.
Yeah, I suppose the system in 2021 was a bit of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it was good in the sense of political inclusion in giving individuals and small parties the chance to win seats in parliament. But on the other hand, it also led to a highly fragmented parliament. I mean, if you look back and think about the number of parties and individuals that were represented in that parliament, you know, you had nearly 40 independent candidates. There were up to 24 small parties as well inside the chamber, in addition to all of the leading traditional blocs and heavyweight parties. And that really just created a high level of incoherence in parliament, in terms of different blocs trying to negotiate with each other and trying to come up with a way forward in terms of the legislative agenda. So I do think that over time, what parliament really needs is a greater cohesion. And that, unfortunately, does happen at the expense of individuals and small parties.
One interesting thing for me was the total number of women MPs who ended up winning in 2021, because, as Hamza said, they were more localized, and you had female community leaders really being able to win. And so, yes, Iraq does have 25% quota system in the elections, where at least 25% of the seats are in parliament are filled by women. We had close to 30% because of those localized elections. So it'll be interesting to see how many women take up seats in the upcoming parliament, because I do think that was one of the benefits of the style of voting in 2021.
You're absolutely right that it's something that we're going to watch. And one candidate that's going to be really interesting to see is Saad Ayad Alawi. This is someone who ran in the 2021 elections in one of Baghdad's districts, despite being the daughter of a former prime minister from a political background. Her community did not elect her. And now she's running once again with the sitting prime minister. You see her posters across Baghdad with her photos of next to her father, the former prime minister, and the current prime minister. And she might be one of those people that her community didn't elect her in 2021, but will benefit from the pass the vote system that we've gone back to, because assuming the sitting prime minister tends to be the most popular candidate in elections and will gather a lot of votes in Baghdad.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see how she does and how other women fare as well. One thing that I think on the flip side is beneficial this time around is that you have many of the political bloc leaders and many members of the coordination framework or the state administration bloc actually running themselves this time around, as opposed to simply having their faces and their names on posters. They're actually running, and individuals can choose them individually or their bloc in the upcoming elections. And I think that is one of the benefits of going back to province-wide elections.
Yeah, but if they aren't going to be taking in day-to-day parliamentary activities, we've seen it before. Someone like Nurdin Maliki, after he was no longer prime minister, ran in elections afterwards, won a seat. You know, he doesn't sit in parliament. So I actually don't know how beneficial that is to Iraq's democracy anymore. Because like I said, if people aren't really choosing their representatives and you've got larger leaders who don't really partake in those activities and allowing their alliances to benefit, I don't know how democratic or representative that is.
Yeah, this is one of the unfortunate trends that we've seen in Parliament over the past decade or so, which is the real decision makers, the movers and shakers in Iraq's politics are no longer under the chamber in Parliament. Decisions are made outside of Parliament, and then those decisions are communicated to their blocs and their bloc heads in Parliament. And so that high level of debate that used to exist in Parliament during the early 2000s and you know, all the way up until 2014, I would say, that no longer exists. And there is, I think, a long-term challenge for Parliament to remain relevant and to ensure that the legislative agenda in Parliament is contested and debated amongst MPs that actually have influence over the blocs that they represent.
And I think this is why institution building should be a greater focus for Iraqis, and ensuring that small d democratic institutions, including the parliament, are set up and built in order to last regardless of who is heading it today or for the next 4 years, and to ensure that democratic norms and institutions are enshrined. And what you said is absolutely correct. It is dangerous, and it is something that is concerning, because those debates don't happen out in the open. They don't happen on the recordings of parliamentary sessions that are broadcast on state TV. They happen in back rooms. And then we have to ascertain exactly what happened and who said what and what sort of deal is being brokered by the proxies of these political bloc leaders that then go on political talk shows and try to spin things in their favor every night.
Yeah, it turns election into just a small part of the whole game, of the whole political process. And that's not ideal. Yeah, the hope is that one day the results of the election indicate to a large extent the shape of the new government. But I think we are far from this, at least in these elections.
Speaking of the shape of the government, during the current regional turbulence, how significant are these elections for Iraq?
I think they're quite significant. This is the first election that happens after a larger period of stability. And in a sense, it's a vote on whether Iraqis want this to continue and whether the political factions also see it in their interest to continue. We talked about this in the last episode. I think to a large level, Iraqis are seeing the benefits of stability, and they want it to continue. And I think the political elite understands this as well. This is why I think, or this is at least my interpretation, that the campaigning is very hard. I think it's even harder than previous elections. And we'll see.
And I'd say even more important than who actually becomes prime minister and who takes up the cabinet seats is the nature in which the government comes to power. What is the deal, the negotiation behind the government that is voted on by parliament? In my view, I think that the Adil Abdel Mehdi government set a very terrible precedent for Iraq in terms of the way a prime minister is nominated, selected, and government is approved. If you remember back in 2018, when Abdel Mehdi was voted in as prime minister, most people didn't have any idea as to who had nominated him. If you remember, we didn't even know who the largest bloc was, which was the designated largest bloc. Recall that the president, Barham Saleh, who had just been elected, didn't release the decree that stated the actual designation of the largest bloc. And so there was this ambiguity about who Abdel Mehdi was actually representing. And that was, for me, a precedent that led to Iraq really going off course in terms of democratic accountability, because essentially, at the heart of accountability, you need to know who the prime minister represents in terms of a party or the people behind him. And I think that we need to try to get back on course. It's my hope that whoever comes to power after these elections, that there is a prime minister who is backed in a very clear way by either a party or a specific coalition. And it's that coalition that can then be held to account for the performance of the prime minister.
How much accountability can you expect, though, given that you have consociationalism and you have to have a large enough bloc in order to push through the cabinet, including the prime minister? We saw with this current government, one of the largest blocs possible formed this government, which then led to almost no accountability, either for the bloc or for the government. I haven't seen a single minister being questioned by MPs this term. So what does that say about accountability and democratic norms?
I think that that's more on the MPs that got elected. We were just talking about 2021 elections resulting in the largest number of independents and smaller parties. And as you know, it only takes up to 50 MPs to question a cabinet minister in parliament. It was on them that needed to hold the government accountable, despite needing a large coalition to form a government. But that's because we saw a lot of MPs, a lot from the Tishrin movement and independents, they're actually quite happy with the performance of the Sudani government, despite being opposition or coming from revolutionary backgrounds. They actually seem to be quite okay with the performance, and many have ended up joining his coalition for these upcoming elections. So I don't think necessarily accountability is because the constitution requires 2/3 to elect a president and forming a consensus government. I think accountability comes from the MPs themselves. They can still participate or partake in forming this government and still holding it accountable.
And I think what Ali referred to about the process of electing the prime minister, and because it was not so transparent, but it led actually to a weak government that was removed eventually. So I think this transparency in the way the government is formed contributes more to stability rather than accountability. And I think in Iraq, because it's a nascent democracy still, it seems to be that the near future, stability is more important than accountability. Eventually, however, I have hope as well that, as Hamza said, the MPs that are elected play their role and do not neglect the duty of holding the government accountable.
And also, I think that the blocs that were responsible for bringing Abdel Mehdi to power have learned some important lessons over the years, which is the dangers of overreach, the dangers of hubris, thinking that you know, you can get everything you want in terms of electing the president and prime minister and speaker of parliament, and then to be able to just sail through just because those are your three picks. If you remember the slogan, Tlatasifar, you know, the 3-0, this is what they were saying, particularly those from the Bina bloc, when they managed to get all three of their, you know, candidates, Abdel Mahdi, Barham Saleh and Halboussi elected. You know, there is a danger that if you engage in overreach, then that can backfire, because we all know that, you know, Iraq sits in a very precarious region, and external actors have a huge impact on the performance, the trajectory of any government. And there are spoilers at every turn. And so I think what I'm trying to say is that these blocs have learned that you actually need to tread very carefully when you're deciding on the nature of the government that you're trying to form. We know we live in a very precarious regional environment where there is, you know, serious escalation from Israel and others. And I think there's an acknowledgement by all sides that whichever prime minister takes power and whatever the shape of the new government, it needs to be moderate in the sense that it balances between East and West.
This naturally brings me to something that I've been thinking about in terms of the election results and what it could mean for Iraq's foreign policy regionally and more broadly. And I think you're right. Lessons have been learned, and the idea of hubris and not taking external considerations and threats seriously has meant that whomever becomes prime minister will need to continue the balancing act that I would say Maliki and Abadi started many years ago. And yes, Adel Abdel Mahdi did not really follow through with that. And even Kadhimi, he swayed the other way and the pendulum swung the other way. I think Sudani has played that balancing game well between East and West. And so the next prime minister, whether it's Sudani with a second term or somebody new, will need to continue that balance.
Yeah, it's not just the prime minister, the whole government itself. You talked about the balancing act under Maliki. He also had Jalal Talabani as president, who was able to play that role really well between Iran and the United States. And we really didn't see that under Barham Saleh. He was very polarizing, and it's no surprise that the two prime ministers, the one that had to resign and the interim prime minister, were under his presidency. And so we need to have political leaders in all institutions that maintain a balance and are on the same wavelength.
And let me just add that, you know, beyond the Iraqi actors, we also have to be very realistic about the influence of external actors. And we know that with every election, both Iran and the United States have huge influence over who is eventually brought into power. And I think on Iran, this is an important moment for them, because obviously with the regional situation and Iran at a very weak point and under threat, they do need to, I think, choose very carefully the kind of influence they want to exert on the formation of the next government.
I think you're right. And the way things transpired between 2018 and 2022 set dangerous precedents. And I do hope that we have a move back to democratic norms and people taking part in elections, and those who want to say that they are part of the political elite and representing Iraq as leadership, that they are actually taking part in the elections. And these are issues and concepts that we can discuss further as we get closer to the elections. So I want to thank all three of you for joining me once again for this very unique discussion. That's it for this week's episode. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to receive notifications about a new episode from Iraqi Voices. Until next time, take care.